Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A handful of state lawmakers are calling for criminal justice reform, and they're looking at things like what qualifies as felony theft.
Florida remains at $300. It has been that way since 1986. It is now 2017, obviously.
Environmentalists are worried about a bill they say could take away local control for power line placement.
The Everglades National Park could be subject to huge towers and power lines. That's a concern.
And diabetes is becoming one of the leading causes of death for Floridians. Now state lawmakers are trying to both raise awareness of the issue and regulate management of the disease. I'm Lynn Hatter, in for Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. A bipartisan group of Florida lawmakers is making noise about criminal justice reform ahead of the 2018 session. Nick Evans reports the group wants to lift the felony threshold for certain crimes and give judges more flexibility in sentencing.
The Project on Accountable Justice at Florida State University pegs the state's prison population at 97,000, with 135,000 more on probation. There are a few ways to calculate incarceration rates, but working with the most recent data from 2015, that's enough to put Florida in the top 10. Although criminal justice reform has long been a priority for politicians on the left, over the past decade or so, the staggering cost of prisons, about $2.4 billion in Florida this year, has pushed more and more conservatives to embrace reform as well.
No one benefits from locking up petty thieves and drug offenders who can be better rehabilitated by drug treatment and alternatives to prison.
This is Sal Nuzzo from the James Madison Institute. The conservative free market think tank couches its position in economics, offering an institutional cost-benefit analysis for prison. Nuzzo says similar reforms in other states have worked,
both in terms of reductions in crime rates and long-term via reductions in incarceration and reductions in the social costs of lower employability, safety net reliance, and poverty.
There are two changes lawmakers are focusing on in the coming year: raising the threshold for felony theft and creating a safety valve for mandatory minimum sentences. Naples Republican Byron Donalds is sponsoring the threshold measure in the Florida House.
Many of our neighboring states have thresholds ranging from $1,000 to $2,500, like it is in the state of Texas. Florida remains at $300. It has been that way since 1986. It is now 2017, obviously. And so it is time that Florida enters the 21st century with respect to our felony threshold limits.
Senate sponsor Randolph Bracey, a Democrat from Ocoee, stresses the long-term impacts of a felony conviction.
If we don't raise the threshold, we are really punishing people who make stupid mistakes for the rest of their lives. They won't be able to get a decent job. It will affect them from getting affordable housing throughout their life. And so it's really time that I think we look at a serious criminal justice reform agenda.
St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Ben Diamond is working on the mandatory minimums measure.
The concern that we have, number one, is that the sentence does not often fit with the just result in a case.
He and Republican Senator Jeff Brandis, also from St. Petersburg, want to allow judges to reduce mandatory sentences for drug crimes in limited circumstances.
This bill does something very simple and straightforward. It allows judges to depart from mandatory minimums when they believe that it's in the best interest of society and the individual that's before them that they depart from the mandatory minimums. It does not give up on mandatory minimums. What it does is it allows a safety valve so that when they feel
judges can only pare down a mandatory sentence if the offense was nonviolent, unrelated to organized crime, and didn't cause death or serious injury. Some of the impetus for the move comes from a bitter fight over a fentanyl measure earlier this year on the Senate floor. After stripping a minimum sentencing provision out of the bill in committee, the sponsor added it back in again on the floor, frustrating lawmakers like Bracey and Brandis.
That bill only went down on the floor of the Senate, that vote went down by one vote. And if you talk to the Senate, I think this year, you would see that that vote might have been different.
Brandis will have to navigate his bill through four committees before he can raise the question on the Senate floor again. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Lawmakers are considering a move that could limit the ability of local governments to make rules about where power lines should go. Regan McCarthy has more.
Environmental activists are raising alarms that by changing the definition of development, a measure moving through the Florida legislature would let utility companies work around local comprehensive plans, or the blueprint that guides how development within a community should happen.
Some possible examples would be the elimination of the ability in the future to plan for multi-story development, to increase density in a municipality in order to avoid sprawl, because you can't have high buildings right next to swaying power lines.
David Cullen works with the Florida Sierra Club, which he says has serious concerns with a bill filed in the House by Pace Republican J.R. Williamson and in the Senate by Brandon Republican Tom Lee. Cullen says the bill could let utility companies build power lines through the middle of planned recreation areas, or could even pose a threat to the Everglades.
If the law is changed to FPL's liking, they could go right back to the PSC, and the Everglades National Park could be subject to huge towers and power lines. That's a concern. But this is a general bill. It would apply all over the state, so it's not just the Everglades that we're concerned about.
And Susan Glickman with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy says their proposal could have an impact on communities that are working to move their power lines underground.
Make no mistake, this bill would allow local governments and citizens to have a lot less input on undergrounding and where and when that happens. So no one's arguing that the Public Service Commission should deal with recovery and costs on undergrounding. But as far as undergrounding in our new sort of hurricane environment, I think you need to consider what this bill might do there.
But David Childs, who represents the Florida Electric Power Coordinating Group, argues the measure could actually be good for the environment. He says it would pave the way for utilities to increase their focus on green energy, like solar farms.
Often those solar generating facilities are going to be in rural parts of the state that need to be connected to the grid. And if you have a transmission line that's crossing multiple jurisdictional boundaries, then you're in the land of the Transmission Line Siting Act, which is what this bill does address, and ensuring that while those transmission lines will still have to meet the local government, environmental, vegetation management, wetland, flood control, et cetera, all those requirements. You don't have to do a series of plat amendments to have the actual zoning reflect that essential infrastructure is allowed in a particular zone.
Child says power lines and transmission lines shouldn't be a part of a community's zoning plans.
Transmission lines are not like your Kentucky Fried Chickens, where you don't want them in the middle of a residential zoned area, or gas stations or any other what you would typically can think of as development.
The measure has passed its first committee stop in both the House and Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
This month is Diabetes Awareness Month, and a bipartisan push is underway to do more to treat the disease. That's among the leading causes of death for Floridians. Sasha Cordner prepared this report.
Kissimmee Democratic Representative John Cortez is a diabetic.
I've been a diabetic, for the last 15 years, and I was diagnosed with sugar levels were high, but I wasn't a diabetic then. I didn't follow the rules, so then I caught the latter effect of it. Now I'm on insulin and every pill there is.
Cortez says he encourages everyone to take the disease seriously.
I just want to reach out to everyone and say, watch what you eat, watch your carbs, follow your doctor's orders. Diabetes is not a good disease. It has a lot of side effects.
Side effects like damage to vital organs due to too much sugar in the blood.
I already had two angiograms to check the heart, and God willing that there's no blockage, so it's not a fun disease, so we got to manage it, take care of it, and try to prevent it. And we need these well care system so we can prevent other folks from getting, especially diabetes in children.
Last year, Cortez carried a bill that required diabetes educators to be licensed. Currently, Florida does not regulate or require licenses for anyone who teach diabetics about how to manage their disease. At the time, groups like the American Association of Diabetes Educators praised the bill, saying any person could claim they are providing diabetes education even if they do not have the proper training. But groups like the Center for Nutrition Advocacy opposed the measure because in addition to physicians, dentists, and pharmacists, dietitians, athletic trainers, and mental health counselors would also be required to have a diabetes educator license. According to that bill staff analysis, the measure impacts the scope of their practice, meaning a paramedic, for example, would not be able to provide diabetes education to their patients without obtaining the additional license. But Jacksonville Democratic Senator Audrey Gibson says that's not her intent. Like she did in the past, she's sponsoring a similar bill in the Senate for the 2018 legislative session.
The diabetes educator can function within their scope of practice, and there will be other individuals who may not have another scope, and so their sole scope would be as a diabetes educator, creating more opportunities for advancement. So the intent is not to impact any current licenses, but to ensure that those who are holding themselves out as diabetes educators are truly trained in that profession.
As a caregiver for her father who has diabetes, Gibson says this issue is very important to her, and she wants to make sure those affected by the disease get the help they need before it's too late. It's why she says she also filed another diabetes-related bill.
In Florida, there's an estimated 2.8 million people with diabetes. The disease is a leading cause of blindness, kidney failure, amputations, and heart disease, and it claims the life of one American every 3 minutes. Senate resolution, which I filed, lays the groundwork for a public education campaign declaring November 2018 Diabetes Awareness Month in Florida.
Meanwhile, Orlando Republican Representative Renee Plasencia is sponsoring the diabetes educators' effort in the House. He filed a similar bill for the 2017 session. The bills never got a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, hurricanes are part of the natural cycle of Florida's coastal ecosystems, but human intervention is changing that.
The benefits of a hurricane don't outweigh necessarily the negatives of a hurricane, especially one of this magnitude.
The adoption of solar power in the Sunshine State is on the rise.
My electric bill had been running close to $200 a month, sometimes more, sometimes less, and I've had electric bills as low as $30.
And a poisonous red tide has been spotted recently in the Gulf of Mexico off Florida's southwest coast. But apparently, the area's avian population has known about it for a while.
These guys couldn't move around very well. They looked almost like they were drunk.
Welcome back to Capitol Report. I'm Lynn Hatter. The impacts of hurricanes on people are well documented and can scar communities for years, but the ecological effects of storms aren't as obvious. Kate Payne brings us this report as we approach the end of the 2017 hurricane season.
Thanks to Hurricanes Irma and Nate, virtually every county in the state saw some storm effects this year. The state's beaches didn't escape the damage either.
Yeah, we lost a lot of sand during Hurricane Irma.
Kara Doran is an oceanographer with the U.S. Geological Survey. She says the erosion would have been a lot worse if Irma had crawled up the Gulf Coast, as was initially predicted. But dunes and barrier islands that serve as habitats and buffers for the mainland still saw damage.
But if it goes over top of the island and washes into the bay and gets transported landward, then it's harder to replace that sand and costs billions of dollars to replace it.
From the human perspective, beach erosion threatens roads, hotels, houses, and restaurants, and therefore tax bases. Florida's First Coast and Treasure Coast along the Atlantic saw dunes cut in half and beaches washed away, leaving boardwalks exposed or collapsing. But Doran says ecologically, a changing coastline isn't necessarily bad in the long term.
Because the beach does have a natural process of rollover where the island can keep pace with sea level rise and storms, and it turns out the birds actually really like that and the turtles like that.
And Jack Rudlow says there could be other potential benefits as well.
Whole big distributions of marine life take place.
Rudlow runs the Gulf Specimen Marine Lab in North Florida.
Well, you all remember the movie Forrest Gump, and you know, he goes out, he's the only boat out there, and they withstand the hurricane. And, of course, all the other boats are washed up. But nevertheless, there's this gigantic bumper crop of shrimp.
In fact, only one shrimping boat actually survived the storm.
Louise, there's Forrest.
After that, shrimping was easy.
But the storms can be incredibly disruptive. Saltwater intrusion can flood marshes, upsetting delicate estuary environments. Wind can shred plants of their leaves. Even the redistribution of nutrients and sediment Rudlow mentioned can suffocate other organisms. That's according to Rob Ruzica, a coral scientist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
We have videos of sponges where you could see that the sediment layer must have been so thick, several inches thick, that the bottom of sponges, large barrel sponges that, you know, are several feet in height, they died almost instantaneously because...
He says the sheer power of the storm surge ripped organisms out of the reefs in the Keys and toppled corals the size of cars.
And corals like that are several hundred years old, you know, 300, 400 years old. So it's quite significant that they had survived so many things. And then during Hurricane Irma, they were either toppled or they were crushed.
He says a healthy reef ecosystem is adapted to handle storms, even benefit from them.
In the modern sense, corals are under a lot of stress, whether it's from water pollution, whether it's from warming sea temperatures, whether it's from issues that are connected to ocean acidification, and whether it's to coastal development, there are a lot of threats.
But as long as human interference takes a toll on coastal ecosystems, they'll be even more susceptible to future storm damage. Hurricane season ends November 30th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A new report says Florida is leading the nation in solar permits for homes. This comes after years of the Sunshine State languishing behind northern places like New Jersey. WUSF's Steve Newborn looks at why residential solar power is finally taking off in Florida, as well as two new co-ops being formed to take advantage of the power of group buying.
Dan Harmon pounds away on Frank Moore's roof in Temple Terrace, installing a solar panel to heat his water system.
So this is a solar hot water heater for, you know, the potable water system for their house supply. So it's a really good way to get hot water in an energy-efficient manner that's clean and good for the environment.
He fastens on the solar panel, which contains copper pipe painted black to absorb the sun's rays. He then drills a 1-inch hole into the roof for the water pipe. Greg Glover is operations officer with Tampa Bay Solar, which has previously installed a series of panels to power Moore's home.
You can see several panels on this roof. They're panels that we installed a few years ago, and it's been working great. 26 panels on this roof.
And how much juice does that put out?
That's about 7 kilowatts.
That's more than enough to power a home. Moore climbs a ladder to check out the progress. He liked the photovoltaic system so much, he decided to power his water heater with the sun.
My electric bill had been running close to $200 a month, sometimes more, sometimes less. And I've had electric bills as low as $30.
He does have one problem, though. During the time he needs the power the most, like during the recent hurricane when he lost electricity, he can't just switch on his solar.
The only drawback I have is when Tico drops off for some reason, and it's in the daytime, I'm not really allowed to use much of the solar that I generate. They say it's a safety issue. People out on the line working can't hear generators running. They can't hear your solar running. And if for some reason it backfeeds into the grid, it could kill somebody.
So let me get this straight. The one time where you need it the most, when you get no power, for instance, you can't use the solar.
Not in the daytime, no.
He's allowed to use only an emergency outlet from his solar panels, enough to power his refrigerator and fans. But people like Moore will soon have a new and possibly cheaper way to power their homes with the sun. Co-ops are being formed in Hillsborough County and Northern Pinellas County by the League of Women Voters and Solar United Neighbors. The co-ops lower prices by using competitive bidding to attract solar power installers. Rick Garrity used to head Hillsborough's Environmental Protection Commission. He now volunteers with the League, which has been planning for a year to start a solar co-op in Hillsborough.
The price of solar panels has come down 65% in the last 5 years. You can get a 30% tax credit on it and another 20% savings through the co-op. It doesn't make sense not to think about going solar. This is the time to do it.
He says there's a set price the installer gives to the cooperative with adjustments depending on each house. They limit the sign-up period to 3 months, and each co-op is capped at about 200 people.
In Orange County, they've done this like 4 or 5 times. The first time was so successful, they just kept doing launches over and over again. So they have hundreds and hundreds of people signed up.
Angela DeMonbrun is Florida Program Director for Solar United Neighbors.
One co-op goes, installations start happening, and then the neighbors start asking questions. Hey, I want to learn more about solar. And then those neighbors come together. It's a grassroots, volunteer-driven effort.
DeMonbrun says there's a good reason why solar is finally booming in Florida.
I think the top one historically has been an environmental reason, but the economics now, the payback period, they're guaranteed for 25 years to keep producing, but now you have a payoff period of 5, maybe just even 10 years, as well as energy costs keep rising.
And there's one more reason why people like Frank Moore are switching to solar.
It's mostly the dollars.
I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
Finally tonight, satellite images this month show a red tide, a harmful algal bloom festering in the Gulf of Mexico, mere miles away from the shorelines of southwest Florida. But as WGCU's Quincy Walters reports, birds have been sounding the alarm for weeks.
Here at the Clinic for the Rehabilitation of Wildlife, or CROW, on Sanibel Island, some birds that came in a few days ago are getting reacquainted with the outdoors in a wired enclosure. Veterinarian Julia Hill is checking up on them.
We have pelicans and cormorants out here right now. It has an in-ground pool with filtered water that we can give them as they recover, and it lets them start to fly again and eat normally and socialize prior to releasing them.
These are birds that naturally don't often make a lot of noise, but these silent birds act as an alarm, signaling that something isn't right in the environment. Last month, the rehab center got an influx of sick pelicans and cormorants.
These guys couldn't move around very well. They looked almost like they were drunk.
These birds had gastrointestinal problems, trouble breathing, some were coughing up blood. Hill says those are symptoms of exposure to red tide. But when these birds started coming in back in October, there were no indications of red tide from satellites or from instruments used to detect it.
There were all zeros around here. We were looking at our samples for phytoplankton. We weren't seeing any of the red tide cells.
Rick Bartleson is a research scientist with the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation's Marine Lab, and he's here at Gulfside City Park Beach testing the water. Based on the reports from CROW and recent satellite images showing a growing bloom in the Gulf, scientists like Bartleson have been doing more monitoring. He says red tide is often difficult to catch with the naked eye.
The discoloration of the water, the red tide, is hard to see wherever there's already reddish water.
The Caloosahatchee River's water is a reddish brown, and the waterways it bleeds into, like this Sanibel Coast, are often the same color. He says satellites are sometimes slow in detecting it because the red tide can be deeper than spectroradiometers can detect, or the red tide may be living in other organisms. Right now, he's casting a net to catch phytoplankton, the microorganism responsible for algal blooms like red tide.
When there's a high red tide concentration, the red tide also changes the other phytoplankton, and it reduces the numbers of other plankton.
And Bartelson says it's like a negative food chain reaction. Bigger organisms that feed on smaller organisms that rely on phytoplankton lose their energy sources. So it doesn't only affect birds. This affects shrimp, turtles, mussels. Oyster and mussel harvesters have to shut down if the bloom gets too bad. Fish can get the stuff in their gills where it paralyzes their respiratory system. Manatees can also die from red tide. Birds are the least likely to die. They're usually the first to make it to shore, where they can easily be observed. Red tide can also impact human health.
If you wanted to smell it, then you could go to Captiva.
Bartelson says that if the wind is blowing towards the shore, carrying toxins of a red tide bloom, and a human breathes it in, it could cause respiratory problems like sneezing and coughing and cause skin irritation.
Stopping the red tide wouldn't probably be possible, but reducing the intensity of the red tides or reducing the duration of the red tides could be possible.
Bartelson says that since nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, and iron fuel red tides, an effort can be made to have more treatment of the wastewater that ends up in the ocean. He says Maryland used to have the same problem.
They reduce their nutrient loadings from huge sewage treatment plants along the Chesapeake Bay and the Susquehanna River from Pennsylvania down to Maryland, and that lowered the nutrient concentrations in the Chesapeake Bay, and that reduced the intensity of their harmful algal blooms.
When asked why Florida hasn't followed that example, Bartelson says,
"It is Florida. We don't have the political will in Florida to do things like that."
Back at the Clinic for the Rehabilitation of Wildlife, veterinarian Julia Hill says it's almost feeding time.
They're just getting fed a lot of fish to make sure that they're in good condition before they're released.
The hope is that when these cormorants and pelicans are released back into the wild, they won't end up getting exposed to red tide again. But weekly updated data shows that the red tide algal bloom is only getting bigger. I'm Quincy Walters on Sanibel Island.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Please join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.